the Ben Greenwood High Performance Podcast, where we share with you the stories, tips, tricks, and strategies of motocross and off-road racers, health and fitness experts, and everyone in between who has an inspiring story to share. Episode 1 of the Ben Greenwood High Performance Podcast. I'd like to welcome you all on board. Thank you for listening. It's something I've been wanting to do for a long time, this podcast, and I've been holding myself back, but I've taken the step and I'm looking forward to bringing you guys a ton of knowledge and a ton of inspiring stories and information from the people who come on this podcast. So why did I call it the High Performance Podcast? High performance to me, it's not about being the best in the world at something. High performance just means being the best version of yourself. It means performing at the highest level possible for you. So to do that, it requires us to have a thirst for knowledge. It requires us to accept that we're going to be a forever student. And it requires us to take failures in our stride and turn them into lessons, because we know that ultimately they're making us stronger. So that's why I'm excited today to have Daryl from Shots Sports Nutrition on the podcast as one of the first episodes, because nutrition is most definitely one of the things that has allowed me to reach a higher level of performance within myself. So what I love about Daryl is he thinks outside of the box compared to the average person. He knows that there's no one-size-fits-all approach when it comes to nutrition, and he's actually developed a product that is adaptable to each and every person when it comes to sports nutrition. So there's heaps of nuggets in this podcast of information, heaps of takeaways and practical tips that you can utilize. We touch on everything from sports nutrition to normal everyday nutrition, and we also get a bit of an insight as to how Daryl's worked with the best riders in off-road in Australia, and a bit of an insight into how they train, how they attack their nutrition protocols, and also their mindset. So what he sees is the difference with these guys' mindset and how they put it together on race day. So there's some heaps of really cool knowledge in there. What we're gonna do is we're gonna do a follow-up podcast to this one in about a month's time, hopefully. So any questions you've got around any of these topics that we speak about in the podcast, shoot me a message, whether it's a direct message on Facebook or Insta, or email me through my website, which is listed at the end of this podcast. Get in touch with me anyhow. Send the questions through and we're going to have a follow-up podcast. So if you do need to ask anything at all, we can ask Daryl and you can get the information you need so you can put that into practical application with your own nutrition on the bike and in day-to-day life. So again, thank you for listening. Looking forward to bringing you heaps of awesome podcast content. Here goes the first episode with Daryl from Shots Sports Nutrition. Please check it out and thank you for listening.
Okay. I'd like to welcome Daryl Griffiths from Shots Sports Nutrition Company onto the podcast today. Daryl's super passionate about endurance sports and sports nutrition. So welcome to the podcast, Daryl.
Hey, Ben, thanks for having me.
Not a problem. I guess firstly, what I'd like to start with is just a bit of your backstory, perhaps. I'm super passionate about nutrition myself, so that's why I was pretty keen to have someone like you on the podcast at the start. I don't know heaps about you, but I know you're obviously passionate about endurance sports and passionate about nutrition. So where did that all start for you?
Started probably well over 20 odd years ago. I've always been interested in performance and that sort of thing, and I'd raced triathlon and I'd raced adventure sport and mountain biking and that sort of thing.
Yep.
It was in my mid-20s as a firefighter that triggered my interest the most, and that was as a firefighter you recognize things really quickly in regards to how people perform in different conditions. And what I did notice was that some firefighters handled heat better than others.
Right.
And that really intrigued me. So probably a year or two, it just became more and more of a of a question that I needed answered, and I wasn't getting the answers from people who were the supposed experts in the field. So I started doing my own research, and what I did work out that the firefighters that were able to handle those hot environments better had a lower sweat rate, and they interestingly had a lower sodium concentration in their sweat.
Right.
And conversely, the guys who struggled a bit more in the heat had higher sweat rates and higher sodium concentrations in their sweat. So I took that information and developed some products, but importantly thought that, you know, this could move across into sports as well and performance. And then I started testing athletes and all that sort of thing. So over right. that time, I've tested over 1,300 athletes in that period.
Yeah. So you were actually working as a firefighter, were you?
Yeah.
Is that what started?
Working as a firefighter and recognizing that regardless of how fit the firefighter was, some just handled the heat much better than others.
Right.
And there wasn't really one thing that was there wasn't a specific reason for it. So that's what triggered my interest in finding out why they were able to.
Right. So, and they were sort of looking for something to help them in those areas, were they, in that sort of their performance in those?
Hydration obviously had a huge impact on how a firefighter performed. And you know, you didn't need to be on the fire ground for very long to experience dehydration, even at a high level. So at the time, we were just given a powdery drink, and it was the exact same product for every single firefighter.
Yeah.
And that didn't make sense to me because we all got different size boots, different size gloves, different size jackets. Everything was customized to our size, yet nothing was customized to our hydration.
Yeah.
So that's where I started to, I thought, well, I need to develop a product that I can, if someone has a higher sodium concentration in their sweat, or they sweat more and they need to drink more, then they don't want to be locked into a set volume of fluid or a set amount of electrolyte. They need to customize. So that was the reason for developing the electrolyte tablet. So if one firefighter might only need one tablet, another firefighter might need three tablets. So,
yeah.
And then that crossed over into the athletes and sport from there.
Yeah. So I didn't do a whole, I don't, like I said, I don't know you that well, but I did a little bit of research before this. I listened to a few bits and pieces of the other podcasts you'd done. Yeah. One of the things I heard you say in one of them, which I really liked, was that nobody's an expert, really.
No.
And when I think I probably agree with you there, when you think you're an expert or when you think you've learned it all, then that's probably when you start to go backwards. So
yeah, you're always learning. And there's always something that'll pop up that you probably haven't experienced before. Experts are, when you're talking about the human body and performance,
yeah,
the fact that everyone is different and then there's so many variables to consider. It's a word that should never be used in sports nutrition or performance or anything to do with the human body. We're far from experts when it comes to the human body.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with you there. Like, I'm sure, like, the more I learn, the more I realize I don't know, really. But
yeah.
I think that's probably one of the cool things about it is there's always something else we can learn, always some another 1% or another 2% we can try and look for.
Exactly. And that's the thing that I teach with the athletes that I do work with is that, you know, while this nutrition plan worked on this day, it's not necessarily going to be the same nutrition plan for the next race because weather conditions will then alter your plan. So, you know, going into an event with the same plan all the time, you can actually, you know, it's something you just need to be mindful of. It's like, you know, with motorbikes and particularly motocross or any type of motor racing, is that you got to set your bike up for the conditions.
Yeah.
And, you know, you might use different tires or a different suspension or whatever it might be, but you're always making those changes. So you need to be considerate that the body's the same. If it's different conditions, you're going to experience different losses.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's I got your book this week and I flicked through it, read most of it. It's a really good read. I think it's definitely one of the better books I've read on sports nutrition for sure.
Thanks, mate.
Absolutely. But I think that's what I like about it the most, and what I like about you is that there's not that one size fits all approach. Because I think too often people are looking for that silver bullet, whether it's nutrition, whether it's training, whether it's getting quicker on their bike, they're looking for that one thing that's going to make them better. But you and I probably both know there is no one thing. Like, it's because we're all so different. What works for one won't necessarily work for the next. So
exactly.
It's about testing, it's about learning and being in tune with what works for you.
100%. That's the key. It's understanding exactly that. There's so many variables to consider. That's the main crux of the book, is that you need to understand your own losses, your own numbers, because someone else's numbers, it doesn't matter what someone else is losing. It's what you're losing.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that. Like in the book, you break it down to sweat loss, sodium and electrolytes, and then separating hydration and calories.
Yeah. So Hadar, which was on recently, is a really good example. So this year was actually quite cool compared to last year.
It was
actually quite hot.
Yeah.
And when you saw the riders finish the 4-hour last year, 2017,
there was
a lot of carnage. Like there were guys just falling off their bikes at the finish. This year was a little different. Being a lot cooler, sweat loss wasn't as great, and neither was the amount of sodium that the athlete lost or the rider lost. So having that understanding there is that if you use the same plan for 2017 in regards to a hydration strategy, then it most likely wouldn't have worked for this year, because when it's cold, you don't need to drink as much.
Yeah.
When it's hot, you need to drink more. And those losses have a huge impact, not just on muscle function, but on brain function. And that's the biggest thing that I try to get across to the motocross riders that I work with, is that the brain and mental fatigue, it's something that you need to avoid. Making mistakes on motorbikes is, you know, there's huge consequences. So
It can end your day pretty quickly.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that, you know, with triathlon or road running or all those other type of endurance sports, you might make a mistake and maybe roll your ankle or, you know, something like that. But which is unfortunate, but, you know, coming off a bike at 100K an hour is a lot different.
Absolutely, yeah. That was one of the questions I was going to ask you. I'd love for you to explain, like, for the listeners, because I've got a little bit of an understanding of this, but how our sport, I guess, is a bit different with that mental load. Like, we know the brain uses 20% of our calories roughly at rest.
Yeah.
Obviously, like, we're reading terrain coming at us at 100K plus an hour in a desert race like Hadar. So that mental function that we're having to perform over on top of the physical function is massive. Like, so that the requirements for our calories and et cetera are going to be huge. How do you see that, like, when it compares to something like a triathlon?
Yeah, so a good analogy is a road runner and a trail runner.
Yeah.
So a road runner can pretty much switch off. They don't really need to use too much brain power. A trail runner, they're always looking for a rut or a stick, or, you know, a log or a rock or whatever. So they're always mindful of where they're placing their foot. So those two runners will do the exact same run at the exact same intensity, but the trail runner will always feel a lot more fatigued at the end because they've just used a lot more energy mentally. Now, from a motocross perspective, you can't actually record how much energy you expend having to process so much information.
Yeah.
You can kind of get an idea of what your calorie or energy expenditure is physically just from heart rate. But to then work out how much energy is being expended by the brain, you know, when you mentioned you're spot on, it's about 20% of your energy is used by the brain just at rest.
Mm.
But to process that information of all those things that you need to be able to make sure that, you know, you just missed that tree or you hit the berm at the right point and you brake at the right time and accelerate at the right time and be able to shift your body weight if the bike doesn't behave like you thought it was, or you have to make some decision very quickly, the brain is utilizing massive amounts of energy. So the main fuel in that regard is glucose.
Yeah.
And while our muscles store glucose in the form of glycogen, that glycogen is only available to the working muscle. So it doesn't release into the bloodstream to then become circulating blood glucose for the brain to access. So we have a pretty small amount of glycogen in our liver, which is released into the bloodstream to help our brain or to help fuel our brain. But how long that lasts for a motocross rider, well, it's depending on the sort of trail that you're riding, it may not last that long because, you know, obviously some trails you need to think a lot more than others. If it's just open dirt track, it's just, you know, pin it. But when you're having to, you know, miss obstacles and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it becomes something that motorbike riders need to be really conscious of and making sure that they are fueling properly so they keep the brain active and functioning as best as possible.
Yeah. So you think that's... So your strategy with that is using obviously the energy gels to have that circulating glucose in the system there?
Yeah, it's when you talk about trying to fuel the brain as quickly as possible and the active muscles as well.
Yeah.
The gels, it's pretty hard to beat. The fact that you can get a large amount of calories in a small volume, but importantly, it has a low thermic effect. And what that means is that it's delivered to the bloodstream very quickly with a very small amount of energy required. So you're not drawing a heap of blood away from the active muscles to the stomach to have to deal with it. It passes through very quickly and becomes a form that the muscles and brain can access quite quickly.
Yeah, sure. So tell me a bit about your product in particular, because I know a lot of gels out there are made from simple sugars and fructose, things like this. And I know you've got a bit of a section in the book there on trying to avoid those types of things. So how have you formulated your gels in particular so they're, I guess, more of a complex type carbohydrate?
Yeah, so the maltodextrins that they use for manufacturing energy gels, there's about 150 different forms of maltodextrin.
Yeah.
So I guess you use the fuel that you'll put in your bike. You know, if you want it to perform well, you put the premium fuel in there, and the same goes with these types of ingredients when you're talking about calories. And so maltodextrin, you've got your expensive maltodextrins, which have gone through minimal process and they don't have a lot of, they don't have any processed refined sugars. So as you get down towards the lower end of those maltodextrins, there's more refined processed sugars, crystalline form, which are cheap. And while it seemingly might do the same job, it's not a fuel that the body will use as quickly or as efficiently. So that's the difference between the formulation with the shots is that we use a high-grade maltodextrin, which is a lot more expensive, but, you know, we're in the business of of performance. We're not in the business of using cheap ingredients and then using a lot more money in marketing and all that sort of stuff, which is probably the main reason is that sports nutrition is dominated by marketing companies.
Absolutely, yeah.
And they'll tell you how fantastic their product is, but there's a big difference between how good someone says something is and how good it actually is. So I think that's the main reason. It's that premium fuel or premium ingredients as opposed to refined sugars and processed ingredients.
Yeah. Because is that like talking about how the gut can tolerate those calories, we're more inclined to sort of experience a bit of distress possibly from those more simpler sugars and fructose compared to the maltodextrin?
Yeah, well, some athletes can handle them fine. Like some athletes don't have any issues. They've got iron stomachs.
Yeah.
But then you've got other athletes that will have they're not more sensitive. It's more that they have a higher response to refined processed sugars and to things that, you know, for whatever reason. So the stomach is so amazingly complex. Like it's that second brain. It's just hundreds of millions of neurons. It's they don't really have a great understanding of the stomach because it's so complex. But some people just can't tolerate refined processed sugars, and it'll just turn their stomach inside out. And a lot of the time, you know, they'll blame, you know, a particular gel or it might be their drink or whatever it might be. But it's about trialing different things, and the whole ethos of the formulations that I've put together is that I need to make sure I use ingredients that are going to be as gentle as possible on the stomach.
Yeah.
Because at elevated heart rate, your senses are heightened, and especially the stomach. Like what it can tolerate at rest is obviously, you know, far better or far greater than what it can when, you know, your heart rate's at 160, 170 while you're flying along a dirt track.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm. So just jumping back to, I guess, the sweat loss and the electrolyte side of it.
Yep.
I know you do the sweat test kit. Is that how, like, to work out our sweat loss and our sodium concentration?
Yeah, it's pretty simple, really. Like, The two things, in regards to hydration, the two main things is actual sweat or the water that you're losing.
Yeah.
And the electrolyte that you're losing in that sweat, and the main electrolyte you lose in sweat is sodium. But what a lot of the riders can do, and I know it's a lot easier if you're able to ride from home, but when they go out riding, start to measure their pre and post weight. So, and it's as simple as measuring your weight nude before going for a ride. And then importantly, measuring yourself with the drinks that you're going to be taking with you. So if you've got a hydration pack or whatever it might be, you weigh yourself with that hydration pack nude.
Yeah.
And then head out for your ride, whether it's an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, whatever it might be. You come back, weigh yourself again nude with that same hydration pack. And if you've drunk some out of there, it gives you a net loss. So your pre-weight and your post-weight, the difference between your pre and post-weight is an approximation of how much sweat you lost in that session. And, you know, two riders can go out on the exact same day, riding the exact same intensity. One might lose, you know, a litre and the other one might lose 2 litres. And it's just the cards you're dealt. Some athletes just lose a lot more sweat than others, and others just don't need to sweat much to keep a safe core temperature. So it's having that understanding, that how much sweat you lose in different conditions, it makes it much easier then to go, okay, well, right, this is how much I'm losing, on this particular day when the temperature might be 20 degrees. I know I need to drink 500 to 600 mils an hour to try and replace what I'm losing. And the thing is, and going back to the stomach, is that you'll never replace the amount that you lose. So yeah, if you lose a liter an hour, you might aim to drink probably 500 to 600 mil an hour, about 50 to 60% of your loss. Because your stomach will never be able to keep up with the amount you lose. You'll always lose more than your stomach can process. So that's an important thing. More for your longer endurance races where those deficiencies start to build up and start to impact on your performance.
Yeah.
You can kind of get away with it in those shorter races because the losses don't build up as much to impact too much on your performance.
Right. Yeah. So the sweat loss is going to be something that's always a variable depending on the environment. But our sweat concentration, that's something that is unique to each and every one of us.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah, so the sodium concentration of your sweat is unique to the athlete. So
yeah.
Of the over 1,300 tests I've done now, the lowest has been 311 milligrams. That's per 1 liter of sweat. So for every 1 liter of sweat that athlete loses, there's 311 milligrams of sodium present, which is quite low. The highest is that I've tested is 3,084. So there's a big range.
Yeah, it's massive.
And those numbers have sort of popped up. When I wrote the book, it was about between 500 and 2,300. But now I've done a lot more testing and, you know, obviously a lot more athletes have become interested in this sort of thing, that I'm seeing a much bigger range in sodium concentrations. Now, this is where it doesn't get complicated, but if you, let's say for instance, you and I had the exact same sodium concentration in our sweat. So let's say we had 1,000 milligrams of sodium for every 1 liter of sweat we lost.
Yeah.
And you and I were riding Hatter, so we knew we were going to be out there for 4 hours. And it was going to be, you know, say 20, 21 degrees. You might be losing, let's say, 1.2 liters an hour sweat. And I might be a heavy sweater and I might be losing 2 liters an hour. Now, although we've got the same sodium concentration in our sweat, you're losing 1.2 liters of sweat. So it's 1.2 times 1,000 milligrams. So you're losing 1,200 milligrams of sodium an hour.
Yeah.
Now, my sodium concentration is the same as yours, but I'm losing a greater volume of sweat. So I'm losing 2 liters of sweat. So it's 2 liters times 1,000. So I'm losing 2,000 milligrams of sodium to your 1,200.
Yeah, right.
Even though the concentration is the same. So this is where having an understanding of your sweat loss will give you a good idea of, you know, making sure that in cold conditions, you're not drinking too much, because having too much can have the same impact as not having enough. But in hotter conditions, making sure you're drinking as much as your stomach can tolerate to minimize the impact that those losses have on you.
Yeah.
Because and this is a thing that a lot of athletes don't understand, is that when you sweat, that water that ends up on your skin to help with cooling, that comes from the water component of your blood. Your blood's about 80% water. So when you're losing that sweat, you're actually reducing the amount of blood you have available. So you've got less blood.
Yeah, right.
So two things happen there. You've got less blood, and blood is our transport system. That's transporting the oxygen, nutrients, glucose to the active muscles in the brain. So when you've got less blood, that delivery is inhibited. But also, as that water component of your blood drops, your blood becomes thicker. And it's not, and the heart's got to work a lot harder to pump that blood around the body. So that's why hydration is so important, because the delivery of oxygen and nutrients and glucose to the brain is so important. But if that blood volume drops, you're not going to get those messages sent as quickly as normal. So, and that's where sodium also has a huge impact on how the brain and muscles function. And just to give it a sort of an insight on sodium, because it gets a pretty bad rap in the media. Everyone's sort of like, oh, don't have salt on your food and all this sort of stuff. But from an athlete's perspective and performance...
Yeah, we need it.
Exactly. If the sodium drops too low in the blood, it's life-threatening. You can actually die from not having enough sodium in the bloodstream.
Absolutely. Now,
it's rare, and it's obviously the extreme, but we're talking about performance here. We're talking about the brain and the muscles functioning. So, you know, you're less likely to get fatigued, but importantly, less likely to make mistakes.
Yeah.
So that's why, you know, sodium is so important, because once the sodium concentration in your blood starts to drop, brain function is inhibited, because that sodium is responsible for that spark that fires off those messages to brake or to accelerate or to turn or to miss that tree and all those other things that, you know, if there's a rider that does something unexpected and you have to do something to avoid it, if your brain's not functioning as well as it could be, then you're less likely to make that decision as quick as you would like. So that's why all these things become really important in regards to how well you're hydrated and how well you're fueling the body as well.
Yeah, for sure. Because that is a real thing, isn't it? Is it hyponatremia? If you actually drink too much water and dilute your sodium levels, like you say, in extreme cases, people have actually died from drinking too much water, thinking they're probably doing the right thing.
Exactly. It actually dilutes the sodium concentration of your blood. And and once again, it's rare, but it's a thing. It's an actual medical condition. But it sort of highlights how important sodium is. And the question is, how low does that sodium concentration need to drop before it starts to impact on muscle and brain function? So that's why with all the guys that I work with, you know, Chucky and Daniel Milner and Lyndon, Fraser, Lockie Stanford, all those guys.
Yeah.
There's probably a few more I've missed out there, but that's the most important thing, is to make sure that they start every race, whether it's a quali, whether it's just, you know, whatever it might be, that they're not starting with any deficiencies, because they know how much it impacts on their performance. Because you'll never keep up with how much you lose. So you don't want to start with any deficiencies to begin with.
Yeah. So in a practical sense, what does that look like for them? Like, I know at Hatter, you had those little gel bottles with the electrolyte on the top for them to have in their, in that little flask at their fuel stops. What are they just running water in their Camelbacks, or have they got electrolytes in there as well?
Yeah, so all the Camelbacks, they've got the tablets in there.
Yep.
So,
and you work that out off their sweat concentration.
Yeah. Yep. So the amount they drank this year, although it's sometimes you need to trial, because the thing is, you could have two riders that lose the exact same amount of fluid, or sorry, the exact amount of sweat, but one can tolerate a greater volume of fluid than the other, because their stomach, for whatever reason, can tolerate more fluid. So it's understanding, you know, how much your stomach can tolerate as well, without, you know, compromising it, without, because once, if you're not sweating much but drinking a whole heap, it has a huge impact on your stomach, and you just, it really impacts on your performance. You just can't ride at the intensity that you would like to. So while it's important to drink and hydrate, there's times where you're going to be drinking too much, and that's why we don't put any calories in our drink at all. It's why we have the hydration and your calories separate.
Yeah,
because if you're relying on your calories in your drink, it locks you into a set volume. You have to drink all that hydration pack to get your calories.
Yeah.
And there's going to be times where you just don't need to drink that much, and you're forcing yourself to. Or you think, well, I'm not thirsty, I don't need to drink much, and you don't get those calories that you need.
Yeah, and you start to fatigue.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, there's going to be some temperatures where it may work for you, but, you know, it's a big risk. And the good thing by separating your hydration and your calories is you can make changes if you need to. If you think, I'm drinking too much, I'll back off, or actually it's hotter than I thought it was going to be, I need to drink more, you can make those changes and adjust accordingly.
Yeah, absolutely. So they've got the electrolyte in their Camelback and then the little flasks, which has how many calories will they consume in sort of per hour?
So it depended on what size tank they were using. So the riders that I was working with that were doing with a smaller tank who were stopping every lap, they would have one energy gel each lap.
Yeah.
And then if they didn't feel like they drank too much or didn't get an opportunity to drink from their hydration pack, they grab a drink as well during their fuel stop, but then make sure that they started off and then were drinking through that through the pit section. The riders with the bigger tank, we had the flasks and we put two gels in each flask. And then we topped it up with a small amount of electrolyte just to make the gel a bit thinner.
Yeah.
And they'd smash that down. So although they were only stopping one every two laps, they were still getting the same amount of calories because they were taking two gels at the one time. But we practiced that to make sure that that two gels weren't too much and they could actually tolerate that amount.
And yeah,
they were fine. That's the key, is that we were able to deliver a large amount of calories, but in a small volume, so it doesn't put too much pressure on the stomach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's probably an important thing to mention too, is that like nothing new should happen on race day. So your nutrition should be a massive part of your training program, testing your nutrition strategies and your hydration when you're doing your practice rides or your training. So it's just another box tick, so you know on the day that you've got that covered, that's going to work for you.
Yeah, exactly. And it's learning what your stomach can tolerate. And that's the thing too, is that, you know, I could set a plan for you and it might be fine for you and your stomach can tolerate it, you know, without any problems. But for whatever reason, and it could be an athlete that's even bigger than you, doesn't have the same digestive system and just can't tolerate the same amount. So it is really important to practice those sort of things, particularly in a 4-hour event like Hatter. It's such a brutal, grueling race.
Or yeah, absolutely.
Any desert race for that, or any endurance race for that matter.
Yeah, absolutely. I think people that haven't ridden one probably underestimate how tough they are.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So in the book you spoke about how you actually had a case of dehydration yourself. Was it in a triathlon, I think?
No, it was as a firefighter.
As a firefighter, yeah.
Yeah.
So what in your case there, do you think that was like too much fluid or lack of sodium or?
It was too much plain water.
Yeah.
Because I was measuring my sweat loss and, you know, I worked out pretty quickly that I couldn't drink, you know, and in some instances I was losing up to 2.5 liters an hour. And, you know, I knew my stomach couldn't tolerate that much, and my stomach could probably tolerate about 1.2 liters. That's about the maximum the stomach can sort of process an hour. So I was drinking just plain water, and it was over three successive days of bushfire fighting.
Right.
And yeah, I just started to feel like crap and ended up on the ground. And subsequently ended up on a saline drip, and I went from feeling like I was going to die and 10 minutes later feeling $1 million. And that was my trigger to finding out what was in that bag.
Yeah. And
it was a 1 liter bag of water with 3,000 milligrams of sodium. So just that, getting that sodium back into the bloodstream just picked me right back up again. And anyone that's had a saline drip, everyone's experienced the same thing.
Yeah.
And it just goes to show that once the sodium concentration of your blood drops too low, then there's really not much you can do. So that became something that I researched really heavily, and was part of all this other stuff that I was learning with these firefighters about, you know, how much sodium each of these firefighters was losing in sweat, and then taking that knowledge then through to athletes and working out, you know, what athletes preferred in regards to the temperatures that they competed in. And some athletes will just do really well in the heat, and some athletes just won't do well in the heat at all.
Yeah.
And that'll come down to the fact that the ones that do well in the heat will have a lower sweat rate and a lower sodium concentration in their sweat. Interestingly, having worked with so many athletes now, is that someone can have a bit higher sodium concentration in their sweat, but the volume of sweat that they lose is very low, so the accumulative amount of sodium they're losing is not that high. So there's so many variables.
Yeah, yeah.
It's been quite interesting.
Yeah. So it's probably a bit of a defining moment for you, perhaps, that dehydration case.
Yeah, it was. It was huge.
Led you down this path.
Yeah, I'd heard about people being on saline drips before and saying how fantastic they were, but it's not until you experience one yourself that you realise.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess from every challenging situation, there's potential value, right?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You know, I took a pretty dire consequence into something that, you know, I learned a lot about, and
yeah,
never got close to experiencing that problem before, because I knew then that I needed to have water and sodium. Like, just having the one wasn't doing the job properly, because I just diluted my sodium concentration so much that it was actually it's pretty scary, you know, passing out and not knowing why.
But, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I know you mentioned before that some of us can tolerate more calories, more volume in the gut than others. So what do you recommend for those people that sort of can't tolerate as much? Have you had cases where people really struggle even with one gel or something like that?
It really just then comes down to timing.
Yeah.
Because obviously as you're taking more gel, so... you know, the thing with motocross enduro is that you're governed by how often you're stopping to fuel. So it's something that, excuse me, it's an individual thing in that I think most people can tolerate one gel every 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Particularly at that intensity, because they're losing so many calories. Like, for instance, Chucky, his average heart rate was about 170 for Hatter, and yeah, that's losing upwards of 900 calories an hour.
It's massive, yeah.
But we're only getting about 230 odd calories into him each hour. And the fact is, that's probably the maximum amount we can get in anyway, because he only gets to stop every hour or so. So... It's really, you know, I can't say, well, you know, just aim for this much, because everyone is so different, but I think one gel every 30 minutes is pretty manageable for most, from my experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. Particularly at that intensity. So if someone's putting around at 40K an hour, then their energy expenditure is not that high. So they could probably warrant taking a gel every hour.
Yeah.
But
I've got a little bit of a theory on that. I think for some, even for the slower riders out there, I think if you probably track their heart rate, because they're I reckon they're definitely not as fit as Chucky. They're definitely not as good a rider, so they're probably hitting every single freaking bump on the track. So although in a lot of cases they're definitely slower, I reckon they're probably, their level of exertion and their heart rate would probably be on a par in some instances. Because they're definitely not as efficient getting around the track as someone like Chucky would be.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing too, is that if you go into one of those races not as fit as you could be, you're really going to notice it a lot.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I know that's another thing you do mention in the book about just how important that training and conditioning is as part of the process leading up to the event.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like when I mentioned that calorie expenditure, is that there's always going to be a gap between how much you're expending and how much your stomach can tolerate. And the better conditioned and fitter that you are, the better you can tolerate that gap. When you're not as fit and not as well conditioned, then you're going to feel more fatigued, obviously, a lot quicker. Particularly, you know, anyone that's doing that event again next year, need to start training, you know, at least 6 months out and getting some, not just on the motorbike, but, you know, getting out on the mountain bike or the road bike and doing 3 and 4 hour bike rides, but making sure that your heart rate's at a, you know, quite an elevated rate for that period of time.
Yeah.
It allows you to condition and be able to tolerate that heart rate zone for a longer period. And when you are fitter and better conditioned, you know, you've switched on, you're less likely to make mistakes as well, because you can tolerate those deficiencies much better.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
So is that something you also help Chucky with? Like, I know I've seen your little video that you did with Chucky, with doing a bit of the off-bike training stuff with him. Is that something you do actually help him out with as well? Or
We got together January because he got back from Europe and he was carrying a bit of weight. But we did some specific work just in the gym that he then took that and then set up his own stuff at home.
Yeah.
But very specific exercises to the actual movements and muscles that you use when you're riding a bike. That was something that he worked really hard on, and areas where he worked on areas that he could improve on. And that's the thing too, is that, you take note of when you get off your bike and where you might be the sorest. And for a lot of riders, particularly because you've got to hug around the tank, the inner thigh becomes really quite sore and fatigued. So, just doing exercises to strengthen up that area. Or it could be your shoulders. It could be the muscles in your back. It could be your glutes, a whole range of things. So just take note of those things that you feel are the sorest and then work on them at home or the gym or whatever, just using different specific exercises to strengthen those areas.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the big focuses, like, we have here in our gym that I train my clients with is all posterior chain stuff, strengthening up the back of the posterior chain.
Yeah.
I think too often people sort of focus on the front of the body.
Yeah.
Like you say, when we're riding the bike, we're using the back of the body a lot. Well, we should be if the back of the body's strong.
You're using just about, well, you're using every single muscle in the body.
You are using it. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. The sport is, I think that everyone's starting to recognize now how fit these, you know, the higher end motocross guys are, and you have to be. You've got to be elite level fitness to be riding as fast and for as long as they do.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking, I think I saw one of Chucky's posts earlier in the year. He said he'd actually lost 10 kilos or thereabouts.
Yeah.
Is that, and that's a little bit of what you've got in the book, which I actually did want to speak about, was your everyday nutrition. Like, having, talking about sports nutrition, race day nutrition, you can't just have a few gels on race day and expect that you're going to perform at your best. Like it does, as you could hopefully share with us, it does come down a lot to what you're eating during the week, of course.
Yeah.
We how actually, you fuel in your body.
Yeah. So it was actually when Chucky and Ty Simmons were racing last year for the KTM team. The year before. Because Ben Graben was the manager at the time. And he said, mate, we need to get Chucky organized with his diet because he just ate crap food. So we sorted out his diet. But the most important thing, because we'd already done it with Ben, with Grabo.
Yeah.
And we did a supermarket tour. And we'd go through and pick out the foods that he'd normally select. And we wouldn't read the nutritional information panel. We'd just read the ingredients list. And what we wanted to eliminate was any refined crystalline form sugars. So it was just looking for the word sugar or sucrose, raw sugar, brown sugar, yeah, that sort of thing.
They try and disguise it in plenty of ways these days, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. So what we do, we go, okay, well, that's sugar. Let's look for an alternative. And people are caught under the impression that fruit is full of sugar and you shouldn't eat it, but it's a naturally occurring sugar. So it's completely fine for you.
Yeah, it's got plenty of fiber in there too, right?
Yeah, and all your nutrients. It's just that refined crystalline form sugar that's in a lot of packaged foods that you need to try and to avoid.
Yeah.
So we did that. And the difference with Grabo is that, you know, he lost a bit of weight, but importantly, just felt so much better, you know, all day, had energy. It's hard to actually get off. And I've had a lot of athletes call me just freaking out. It was like they're coming off crack or something like that. They just have a really hard time. So we did that with Chucky, cleaned up his diet. And he was actually did a really good job. He noticed a huge difference. But most importantly is he became a lot more consistent. He wasn't good one week and then not so good the next. It was just consistency all the time.
Yeah.
So that was the biggest thing. And just that understanding that when you do eat well, a lot of athletes under the impression that I do all this exercise, I can eat whatever I like. But it's actually it's the opposite. You do all this exercise in that you need to be even cleaner because eating crap food just takes up too much energy. It requires a lot more energy to metabolize. So that's energy you can be using somewhere else.
Yeah.
Just eating clean and just looking at food and going, okay, how many processes has this food been through? And that's the best way to look at it. Fruit and vegetables, like no processes or nuts, you know, all those sorts of things. So, yeah.
Yeah, just trying to minimize as much processed food as possible.
Absolutely.
Really good approach.
Which is hard to do sometimes, you know, because you've got to be more organized and better prepared. But
definitely.
Certainly, it's well worth it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I guess that's my thought process there too. Like I'm definitely guilty of, I used to eat terribly. It's only been the last 5 years that I've cleaned my nutrition up. And I was of the exact same belief that I was active. It didn't matter. I'd just burn it off.
Yeah.
But of course, we know that's not true.
No.
But that's my thought process now is that particularly at a 3-hour or 4-hour event, we're placing a lot of stress on our body. And then if you're going to Macca's on the way home or whatever it is, then you're just placing a shitload more stress on your body. So
that's it.
And stress is like one of the biggest killers.
Yes.
It's going to impede our health and our recovery. So
that's it. It all starts with the cells.
Yeah.
And if the cells aren't functioning properly, nothing else is going to follow. So when you eat processed, refined foods, because the body doesn't recognize it, you're actually borrowing nutrients from your own cells to metabolize those foods. And you're continually borrowing because those foods don't have the nutrients required to actually for the body metabolize the food quickly. So you're having to borrow all the time. And that's the thing. What you recognize is that you don't need to be having coffee all the time or stimulants to make you feel like you feel okay, because you feel good all the time anyway. So that's the big difference when you start to clean up the type of food you eat.
Yeah, for sure.
Like never touch any soft drink at all. Like just cut them out completely.
And even like your normal sports drinks that you get, people think they're like Gatorade, things like these, like not the best choice, are they?
No, well, it's all refined crystalline form sugar. There's nothing good about a soft drink.
Yeah.
No.
I some of the top writers I do follow, I see them all the time posting up photos on their stories of what they're eating on the way home, like their cheat meal on the way home, their recovery meal.
Yeah.
Which is takeaway like fried foods. Like and a lot of people think that's the best time to have a cheat meal is after, but it's quite often not the case, isn't it?
No, it's not at all. It's your body, you've just put your body through, through intense workout that, you know, the last thing you want to be eating is foods that your body's not going to respond to or relate to. And it actually needs to work harder to metabolize those type of things. So you're using more energy. When you're young, you can get away with it because you're generating so many cells, regenerating so many cells. But as you get older, it becomes even more important to eat properly, because you're just not generating as many cells anymore. And you just feel like, it's just a downward spiral when you're not eating the right things.
Yeah, we definitely start to pay for it a bit more when we get older, don't we?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, your recovery is much slower. And that comes down to the fact you're not generating as many cells.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what are some of the recovery protocols you recommend for your guys?
Hydration is the most important thing.
Yeah.
That making sure that you get that blood volume back, and importantly, get that sodium concentration back as well. A lot go to the cupboard and grab their protein powders, but it's not really doing much for you. Rehydration is the single most important thing. Probably not so much during winter where it's cold, you're not losing as much, but summertime when you're active and sweating a lot, that will have the biggest impact on how well you recover after each session.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like with the sodium, like we mentioned before, when you do sort of clean up your diet, that's another thing that's in every single processed food is sodium, right? So when you do go to more of a whole foods type approach with your diet, it's really important to actually add salt to our meals, isn't it?
It is, particularly for athletes.
Yeah,
sodium gets a bad rap, but it gets a bad rap to 65% of the population who are overweight and eat a lot of processed foods and don't do any exercise.
Yeah.
And that, unfortunately, is what we hear most of. It's about a demographic that is in no way relatable to the guys you work with or the people I work with. So adding salt to your food, and, you know, a good salt, like, you know, Himalayan pink salt or sea salt or something like that, is actually beneficial, because we don't manufacture our own sodium. We need to replace it. And particularly in the warmer months when we're losing a lot of sweat, it's actually a really difficult mineral to replace. Mm. Every single athlete I work with starts to put salt in their food and notices a difference in how they feel.
Yeah.
Such an important mineral.
Yeah. Mm. And like you said before, it's a bit like sugar, isn't it? Like it's totally refined table salt.
Yeah. Bleached.
Exactly. So looking at, yeah, your Himalayan salts or Celtic sea salts, things like that are a really good option as opposed to your standard table salt.
Yeah, just a, you know, least amount of processes as possible. Yeah. You know, and I always use, it's good working with motorsports because you always use the analogy that you just wouldn't put shit fuel in your bike.
That's exactly right. That's what I tell all my guys.
Yeah. So, you know, the same thing goes for the body. It's a machine. So, you know, you're only going to get out what you put in. And if you put a standard cheap fuel in your bike, it's just not going to go as well. And the body's the same thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. So one thing I would love to ask you, Daryl, you've obviously worked with all these high-level racers and top-level athletes. Mindset. I believe it's probably the defining factor that separates the best from the rest is their mindset and their ability to, I guess, block out all the noise on race day or when they're competing and get in a flow state and just ride how they know how to ride.
Mm.
Is that something, or how do you see that, like the mindset that these top level riders bring to race day? Is that something you think that we're sort of born with, or do you think it's something that is trainable?
I think a lot of it is genetics. There's going to be some riders that can process information so much faster than others that they can just read a track or a trail and just be able to make a decision so much quicker and so much more efficiently than someone else. So that's one thing. From a mindset or a mental thing, when things start to get harder, some athletes have the ability to still manage to go the same pace, even though they're hurting massively. Other athletes will get to that point where they start to hurt and they'll just start to slow down. Now, I don't know if that's trainable. I think a lot of it, it's just they're able to do that. And you see it with endurance athletes all the time, is some are able to tolerate pain much better than others. When things start to really hurt, they can just continue to hold that same pace, where others just can't, they're just not able to. So it's actually one that I'm really interested in, and I've been sort of watching for many years over different endurance athletes. You know, it may be trainable to a certain point, but there's some athletes that just naturally have it.
Yeah. I think it's almost like mindfulness, almost like being able to not, like when it does get painful, when it does get hard, not focusing on that, being able to sort of block that out and just focus on what you're actually doing.
Just getting the job done. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, there's some athletes who are just, like I said, they can tolerate pain just much easier than others.
Yeah.
And be able to shut it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting.
It is. It's fascinating. Yeah.
Mm.
I think one of the big things that can make a big difference is just being prepared, like being conditioned, knowing you've done the training, knowing you've got your nutrition right, all those little things, ticking all those little boxes in your lead up, in your preparation. So when you get to the race, if it's Hatter or whatever it is, then you know within yourself that you've done everything within your power, so you're ready. You're not questioning yourself, you're not doubting yourself.
Yeah, exactly. That's you know, if you're going into an event and it's the day before and someone's asking you, what should I do? It's always a bit of concern. So, you know, if it was an hour race, then, you know, no worries. You can get away with it. But that third and fourth, like, you know, after 2 hours, those last 2 hours in that event, it's always so hard because you've got to a point where those deficiencies start to impact on muscle function, cramping starts to happen. You start to make little mistakes like change down when you're supposed to change up, or change up when you're supposed to change down, or brake too early, or grab too much front brake. You know, not execute the turn as well as you'd like. All those sort of things start to creep in. And that's got to do with, you know, whether you've been fueling yourself properly, whether the brain's getting, you know, a good amount of glucose, whether the blood volume's dropped, whether the sodium concentration in your blood's dropped, all those things, whether it's all three or one of them, it'll start to impact on how you function. So if you go into that race knowing, okay, this is kind of much how much I'm going to be expending or losing, this is how much my stomach can tolerate in these sort of conditions, then having that plan makes things, like you say, just so much easier going in with that understanding.
Yeah, it just removes another level of doubt or uncertainty, I suppose.
Definitely, definitely.
Yeah. So a couple of things I did want to ask you, mate, to sort of wrap up a little bit. You've obviously, like, built a business from the ground up.
Yep.
And like even to be a firefighter who, I guess, experienced a bit of dehydration, and then to take it, to be that inquisitive, to take it to that next level, to actually produce a product that could benefit people. Like, that's pretty, you must be pretty driven, pretty motivated person. What, is there any sort of daily routines or non-negotiables you sort of try and include in your day to maintain motivation to keep moving forward?
No, I just love, because it's always changing, and I'm always working with different athletes.
Yeah.
And so that's always new. And the best thing is that you're always learning something new as well. So, you know, that's why I never, and we started on that word expert, and why there's no such thing, because every single athlete I work with, while I might be the same sport, there's going to be something different that you learn from them. And whether that is their unique physiological makeup, or their digestive system, or their mental function on how they handle things is always different. So that's good. But from a business perspective, it's always been about giving the athlete something that will help them, will benefit them. But most importantly, making sure that they have an understanding that while they are using the product, they need to ensure that they are actually using it properly, and to trial different things. And interestingly, with the electrolyte tablet, a lot of it comes down to palatability. So there might be some athletes that, you know, might, let's say for an instance, you have a two liter hydration pack. Some athletes might put four tablets in that hydration pack and find that, okay, well, that tastes nice and it's palatable. But then other athletes will sort of play around with it, go, okay, actually, you know what, I'm going to try and see if I can tolerate a greater mix. And they might put six tablets in a 2 liter pack. And interestingly, it comes down to palatability. And if someone has a higher sodium concentration in their sweat, they can tolerate that six tablet mix and find it quite palatable. But if someone has a lower sodium concentration in their sweat, they would try that six tablet mix and find it too overpowering. So just different things like that, and being able to communicate with the athlete, and if they're having problems, you know, just refining things and seeing, you know, okay, well, this worked here, but, you know, what problem? Oh, well, I'm probably drank too much or not enough, or I'll get bike riders ring up, say, oh, you know, had some real stomach problems. We go, okay, well, what'd you drink? Oh, this much. I drank the same as much as I did the race before. Okay, but what was the temperature in there? Oh, it was a lot colder.
Yeah.
Oh, right. So I didn't need to drink as much. And they're like, okay, right. So there's all those sorts of things. And that's always something that the athlete can then take away and because they've experienced it, they can sort of recognize the mistake that they've made and then fix it for next time. So there's always those things which keeps it fresh, which is good.
Yeah, always learning.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
forever a student, eh?
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone, well, mate, the human body is so freaking complex, and there's so many variables that, yeah, we'll never have a true understanding of it, because what will work, like, you know, we've said it before, what's going to work for one's not going to work for someone else. So that's why you need to keep, you know, practicing and working out what is the best formula for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you had one tip for young riders that are like coming through the ranks, who are looking to sort of, I guess, be the next Chucky or the next Milner.
Yep.
Trying to take as far as they can. What would you say to them?
That they have to have a mindset of an elite athlete.
Yeah.
They have to recognize that for them to be a very, very good motorbike rider, they have to have a fitness level of, you know, your top triathletes, top runners. Like, they have to have that mindset that they can get to the gym and do those workouts when they don't actually feel like doing them. Getting out on the mountain bike or the road bike and doing those 3 and 4 hour rides, and being as fit as they possibly can, and conditioned so they can tolerate the rigors of riding that intensity for that period of time, because it is extraordinarily difficult. And sadly, most people don't understand how grueling endurance motocross riding is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a tough sport.
Absolutely, and like we say, it's super stressful on the body. So I think that's probably something I experienced from not eating correctly. Like, I probably ended up pretty unhealthy towards the end of my career, a racing career.
Yep.
From just, not eating the right food, not eating enough foods and not eating the right foods. It's not a good place to be.
Yeah.
Thanks for everything today, Daryl. It's been awesome. Yeah, nice. Awesome amount of knowledge and some nuggets there that people can take away, some practical knowledge.
Yeah.
Can we tell the listeners where they can find you? Where's the best place for them to get a hold of your products and maybe even purchase the book?
It's shotsnutrition.com.au.
Just straight through the website?
Yeah, straight through the website. That's the best place to go.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right, Daryl. Thank you very much for being on today.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for having me, mate. It was good talking to you.
Thank you.
All right, mate.
Thanks for listening to the Ben Greenwood High Performance Podcast. For more information on this podcast episode, please check out the show notes. And to check out more of my content, shoot over to my website, www.100%strength. That's www.100%strength.com. 100% strength to us means giving 100% effort to any challenge we face, whether that's in life, whether that's in the gym, or whether that's out on the track. So you can check out some of our free content online. We've got a blog there. We've also got an email list you can subscribe to stay up to date with events, tips and tricks on a weekly basis. And I'd really appreciate if you give us a follow on Facebook or Insta too. Until the next episode, give it 100%. Peace out.